Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Thanks for tuning in to the Money Tree Investing Podcast, your source for investing and money matters. You're listening to episode 20 with Preston Pish. I'm your host, Andrew Sather from eInvestingForBeginners.com, and we will be joined with decades of experience from our panel at the end of the show. Today's guest is Preston Pish. He is the founder and owner of Buffett Books, and he has a YouTube channel with over 100,000 YouTube subscribers. He's also the founder and owner of a private holding company, and I'm really happy to hear what he says about investing and Warren Buffett, as well as I'm a huge fan as well. So I want to thank you for coming on to the show, Preston.
Andrew, thanks for having me. Really excited to be here. I'm a really big fan of what you guys are doing, especially with your panel discussions that you guys have after each show.
Hey, we really appreciate that. It's great to hear that we're having some influence out there. I want to jump right in because you are sort of the expert on Warren Buffett. You have two best-selling number one books on Amazon about Warren Buffett. And I think there's some things about Warren Buffett that people don't realize. Like, everybody knows he's rich, obviously, but people don't realize he kind of comes from some humble beginnings. For example, when he was younger, I remember reading somewhere that he couldn't afford a crib for his first child. So they just made a bed out of bedroom drawers. So for people who aren't familiar with Buffett and kind of his background, can you give us an intro about him and then also talk about your website, Buffett's Books?
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you for the introduction and everything, Andrew. So a lot of people have a misconception about Buffett as far as maybe he came from a poor background or he was a rags to riches type story. Although he's a self-made millionaire, let me rephrase that. He's a self-made billionaire of over $70 billion. The thing that people don't realize is in his early beginnings, where a lot of those stories originate, he was actually just a miser. Okay. And a lot of people think that he was, you know, just a poor upbringing background or whatever. But his dad was actually elected into Congress. Some people don't know that. I think he only did one term. But Buffett himself, he went to Columbia University, studied under a professor called Benjamin Graham, who a lot of people refer to as the value, the godfather or the founder of value investing. And whenever he learned under Graham, he learned all these principles about accounting and these higher level financial ideas and concepts. And so he was armed and pretty well to do. I mean, he was making decent money. He didn't need to have his first child sleep in a drawer, which is what he did, because he was just really that cheap whenever he was younger. There's a quote that he has actually said. He said he was working his way towards cheap, was I think the quote that he used. But yeah, so it's some misconceptions. There's a story about whenever he was evidently was staying at the Plaza Hotel in New York. And he had called up one of his friends to bring him over a six pack of Pepsi because he was too cheap to order a drink from the guest services or something like that. There's a bunch of little stories like that out there. But most of his humble beginnings are because he was such a miser. And I think, you know, for your audience and for investors, I think the real takeaway and like really the key point that we can take away from this is that financial success really comes down to two variables. And the first variable is obviously the one that everyone focuses on, and that's how much money, what's your stream of revenue? And the one that everyone neglects, which Buffett obviously paid a lot of attention to whenever he was younger, was minimizing your expenses. So it's just what comes in versus what goes out. And the difference between that, the delta between that, is your profit margin, and that's what leads to your financial success. So Buffett obviously liked to focus on both of those aspects. And, you know, for people that are listening, I think a lot of people only focus on the one and not the second.
Yeah, I think that's really key. I mean, it's kind of almost sexy to talk about, you know, how much income you can bring in and how you can increase that. But I think that gives us a great perspective on, you know, a lot of people who are wealthy, they don't do it because they're doing like these crazy cool things. Really, when you break it down and look past the surface, it's a lot of discipline and a lot of, like you said, controlling your expenses and really saving and sacking away a lot of money so that you can grow that money even greater amounts later on.
Yeah, and people don't realize, I mean, you could make $50,000 a year and spend $25,000 to net $25,000, and you'd be in a better position than, call it, a professional athlete that makes $500,000 a year and spends $470,000 of it. And that's something that, you know, a lot of people, you know, they don't see that, or he spends all of it or even goes in debt. And I think a lot of people don't really think of it in that light, that they have to make multi-millions every single year in order to get ahead. And that's not necessarily the case. You know, what you're expending and what your expenses are is almost, well, it's an equal portion of what the revenue is that you're bringing in.
I think it's interesting too, because I've heard that Buffett still lives in the same house that he bought like 40, 50 years ago, before he was even extremely super wealthy. And just kind of a testament to how he really keeps his expenses down to make more money. And, you know, that's a great example you bring up. And I always talk about on my website how, you know, even somebody who just makes $50,000 a year, the median income in the United States, if you can just sock away 10% of that a year, and if you have a long period of time where you're investing, let's say you're like 25 and you have 40-year time period, you can make that into $2.4 million with just average 10% returns. And so there's a lot of different things people can do with not that much income. You just have to really be disciplined, and not enough people even get to that like small 10% or 50%, like you said.
Yeah. Andrew, I wanted to follow up to your second part of the question, because I didn't answer it. Hmm. The reason and how I kind of got into Warren Buffett and studying him was I was just really interested. And from the start, it was like, I want to study the person who's the best at what they do, because if I do that, then hopefully I can maybe learn something from them. And so at the time, you know, Warren Buffett was one of the wealthiest people in the world from stock investing. So I just started pouring in and just studying him like crazy. And what I discovered was that Buffett had based all of his investing principles and all of his thought process really from this Benjamin Graham, who was his professor at Columbia. And so Graham had written a book called The Intelligent Investor. He also wrote another book called Security Analysis. And so what I did is I started just finding any and every book that Buffett had read, and I started studying it myself to the point where I felt like I was really understanding Buffett's thought process and why he makes different decisions, how he calculates intrinsic value on certain stock picks. And so I had all this knowledge from reading all these different books, and I was like, I got to share this with people, because I kind of learned it from the ground up. I didn't study economics in college. I was an aerospace engineering major, so I had a math background, but I didn't have a finance background. So I was studying all this information. I was like, I got to build a website or something to put this out there. And so that's why I have a website, buffettsbooks.com, because I have all these different videos from YouTube and stuff on there to teach people about these books that basically taught Buffett how to be the financial success that he is.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I've seen some of the YouTube videos that you put up on your, I think both on YouTube and on your site. And it's fascinating because you just break it down. We'll get into this, but you break it down and kind of show every step of what Buffett teaches and what he follows. And like you said, the Benjamin Graham, and I'm sure you read The Intelligent Investor and perhaps Security Analysis. Those are the books that kind of were the foundation of what Buffett teaches and how he invests today. Now, moving on with that, as far as the markets go, and I know Buffett has a lot to say about the markets, how do fear and greed play a role in how the markets work and kind of how they affect investments?
So that's a really good question. I like that question. You know, it's interesting because whenever I kind of explain the market to people, the main thing is really the fear and greed cycles that the market goes through. And Buffett talks about this a lot. And so one of the examples that I like to use whenever I'm talking to people about this idea is I try to move away from the stock market to kind of demonstrate things to people. So if you talk about the fear piece of it, it really comes down to survival instincts. So everyone's armed with these survival instincts. So if you and I were standing on the road and let's call it a major city, we were in New York City or something, and this mob of people, just say like 100, 1,000 people or whatever, start just charging towards us, and we're just standing there looking at these people coming at us, our natural reaction, our instinctive reaction is, hey, we need to turn and start running with this crowd of people. Okay. And that's the fear instinct. And so in the stock market, whenever you see people selling off at a very large volume, everyone kind of wants to move in that direction, even though that they might take a loss. They're more scared of what they could lose even further than where what they've already lost. So they sell out of that position. So that's the fear side of it. So the greed side of it, the example I like to tell people about the greed side, stepping away from the market again, is I lived in South Korea for a little bit, and I was in a market. They have these big markets in the city of Seoul over there. And in these markets, there's these vendors that are selling clothes. And so I'm walking through this market. I don't really understand the language that well. So I'm just really observing. My eyes are probably my best sense at that point of just like observing everything. And I see this mob of people just crawling all over these clothes that are in this pile. And the pile of clothes are just on the street. The clothes weren't hung up. And next to this pile of people that are like searching through these clothes are other vendors where their clothes and products were like nice, neat, and orderly on shelves and hung up and things like that. But all the people were in that pile. And I'm thinking to myself, why are these people in this, like searching for the clothes in this pile? And what it really came down to is everyone was attracted to the, I think when the first person went, they're starting to dig through the pile, and then the other person sees, oh, there's a person there. So then they start digging. And so it was like this mob mentality of greed that they're trying to find the best deal. And since everyone else was there, they all were just trying to pile into finding the thing that they didn't even know that they were searching for, you know?
Right.
And so it was just, for me, symbolically, and when I think about that and you think about the stock market, so you're at work and your buddy says, oh, I just made $1,000 in the stock market on this one pick or whatever. And that just starts the spread. And you see the same exact kind of psychology, this groupthink, if you will, to flocking towards what they think is a great deal and something that they're missing out on. And so the market goes through these cycles, and it's almost like a water wheel. Whenever the water starts spinning on that wheel one way, it keeps going, it keeps going. And then all of a sudden it fizzles out, and then it starts going back the other way. Okay. And that's, I guess that's the best way I can describe the fear and greed cycle to people. The key points, I guess, if there's one thing that I could say that would really kind of summarize the key points here, is that if you want to take advantage of that, so that's the cycle, okay? But I'm of the opinion, Buffett and some of these other billionaires are of this opinion, that you can exploit that situation for what it is. I don't know if exploit's probably the best word, but you can take advantage of that as an investor by buying at the right times, whether that's fixed income securities or whether that's equitable, you know, stock or whatever. If you buy at the right time based on those fear and greed cycles, you can really be advantageous and have these huge returns like people like Buffett have. And that's how he's worth $70 billion. So the key points, and I think the key way to strategically do that, really comes down to a couple different things. The first one is you have to be knowledgeable. Okay. And I think a lot of people in the market are not knowledgeable. And the way that my personal recommendation for people to become knowledgeable, if you're going to study one thing, I'd say you need to study corporate accounting if you're doing individual stock picks. Because if you don't understand that, you're going to have a hard time figuring out what the value of anything is.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is the impact that interest rates have on the market. So as this market comes up higher, the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, and that has an enormous impact on the value of everything within the economy. So that's the second thing is interest rates. And then the third thing is, I think, opportunity cost. I think a lot of investors do not understand the idea and the concept of opportunity cost. And that's where Buffett really separates himself, is by understanding those three things.
Yeah, those are some really great examples. And I think if people want to learn about interest rates and how it affects the market, I remember reading, I think it's Winning on Wall Street by Martin Zweig. And that one has like a whole chapter or two just on interest rates and how they affect the stock market. And I think it's really a great book that people can go check out. I'll link that up on the show notes along with some of the other books we talk about today. Now, you mentioned on your site how Buffett has four rules about stocks. I think these rules are really important because you know, like you said, people don't have the knowledge, and people can just go out there willy-nilly and think that they can make a lot of money just because their neighbor did it. And come to find out, you know, once valuations come down and a stock kind of loses its bubble, a lot of people can get burned. So people really need to learn about, you know, what's a very prudent way to pick stocks. And so you have these four rules, that Buffett has. One of them, let's talk about the first one. A stock must be managed by vigilant leaders. Can you explain what maybe Buffett was meaning by that, and then how exactly we can follow that rule?
So I think for Buffett, it's a lot easier for him to assess this one than your common investor, just because of the place that he's in and the network and the capital that he's employing. He has at first hand interaction with the leadership, and he kind of knows whether they're going to fit the same idea, thought process that he kind of has. So he has a little bit of an advantage there. So what I like to tell investors is, if you want to invest in vigilant leadership, what I like to try to do is find businesses that are well managed, that have, and the way that I determine whether it's well managed is I look at like the debt levels. What's the debt to equity on the company? Is it really high? If it's really high, then you probably have you can make the assumption that the manager of the company is probably very risk, you know, he has no problem assuming a lot of risk. I like to try to minimize my risk. So for me, whenever I look at this principle, when I'm trying to invest in stock, I'm looking for a company that's very stable, a company that something that has done a very good job at managing their finances. So I dig into their current ratio. I look at their debt to equity ratio. I look at what their coverage ratio is over their debts on their income statement, stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. I also preach debt to equity. I'm super risk averse as well. And I think you can really look at how management is, what their attitude is just by how much debt they keep on the balance sheet. That's a great way to kind of weed out some of the bad companies, and a lot of the bankruptcies that we've seen in the past is just simply because of over leverage. Now, the second rule, a stock must have long-term prospects. Sounds obvious, but I think there's a lot more to that than what we're saying here. So can you explain that one?
Yeah, so Buffett, I mean, he always looks at, and I think this goes back to the root of what separates Buffett from everybody else. Buffett looks at every single individual stock pick as if he's buying an entire business in itself. And I think for a lot of people, they never make that connection. They just think of a stock as like some fictitious thing and not a real business behind it. So whenever he buys that company, he wants to own it forever. He usually uses the example of, if I went on to Main Street and I purchased, let's call it a coffee shop or whatever shop you want to call it, and I bought that, I wouldn't turn around the very next day and sell it because maybe they had one less customer show up than what they had the previous day. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And so what he says is, you know, if I'm going to buy a business, I want to own it for the long term. And the main reason he likes to hold things for the long term is he doesn't like to pay the capital gains whenever he sells it. So that's one of the first thing. And the second reason is because if he has a good business, it's making a lot of money, why in the world would I sell it? And that's really his two main reasons.
I mean, it sounds simple, but I think it's something that a lot of people might brush over because a lot of his success is due to not picking the right companies, but being in the right companies for a very, very long time. I think like Hershey's, and I believe he was in Gillette for some time, and maybe Procter & Gamble, but these are companies that compounded their gains and had, you know, great earnings over very, very long periods of time. And that's really how he was able to grow Berkshire from however small it was to the huge, you know, giant that it is today, is because of this exact principle of keeping your stock for a long time and letting it grow organically and letting the dividends compound and just letting everything work for you and let time work for you. And, you know, it's not about having all the best picks, but it's really about having the right mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. He's extraordinarily patient. And I think that's one of the keys in order for this to actually occur and actualize.
Yeah, definitely. Third point, rule that you had on Buffett about stocks: a stock must be stable and understandable. Can you shed some light on that?
So yeah, this one is, and whenever you read Security Analysis, which was Buffett's big, giant, like 600 page textbook at Columbia that Graham wrote, in Security Analysis, one of the things that I took away from that book that was just prevalent throughout the whole thing was stability. And what it really comes to, and this is really closely tied to the next principle, which is finding a company that sells at a great price. The intrinsic value is really good. And Graham and Buffett have the opinion that if you can't come up with a company or find a company that has very stable earnings, stable results, very predictable, it's very hard for you to determine what it's worth. Okay. And that's where I'd say that this is probably one of my favorite principles that he has, because whenever I look at a stock pick and it's just kind of all over the place with, call it its earnings or its debt levels or whatever you want to, you know, whatever financial term you want to throw out there. If it's not stable and predictable, it's something that I immediately write off as not being a potential pick, because I don't have the confidence, the probability of being able to say, yeah, I think in 10 years from now, I think this company is going to be able to earn at this level. Okay. And if I can't determine that, I can't determine what I think the company's worth. And if I can't figure out what the company's worth, why in the world would I buy it? It'd be like, and I should probably talk about this when we talk about the valuation, but I'm just going to kind of hit on it right now. If you were going to go buy a business on Main Street, let's go back to that scenario, and you knew that the business made $100,000 a year, okay, I know that I might be comfortable paying $500,000 to own something like that because I'd get a 20% return on my money. But if I was going to go buy that business and I had no idea what the earnings were and I had no idea what I was buying it for and I just bought it for $5 million, okay, that makes no sense. And whenever you're doing stock investing and people aren't determining what's their profit, what is it selling for, they're not doing that calculation. They're essentially going out and buying that business for, call it $5 million, or they might buy it for, you know, $100,000. Who knows? But I think the key here is you have to know what you're paying for the business if you're going to buy it. And anybody who's buying one share or 100,000 shares, you are buying a business whether you like it or not. And you got to know what price you're paying for that. So if you're going to pay a price, you need to know that you have stable results, predictable results, so you know what you're getting. And that's really what this principle is hitting on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you said earlier, a lot of people don't have that much knowledge about the stock market. Someone might think, well, how do you know that? How do you know that people aren't knowledgeable? You just have to look around and see all the crazy business models that are out there and these companies that aren't even pumping out profits and people are pouring millions and billions of dollars into them. And it's really prevalent, especially right now. We're recording this in November of 2014. You see companies out there with just, you know, no stability, like you say. The earnings are minimal, if any, and people are still piling money, hoping that the person who they sell to is going to pay more than what they're paying for. And I think because this fear and greed cycle that we talked about is prevalent, that's exactly what gives us our opportunity. And you know, if you just take the time and the discipline and the patience to learn these principles and apply them to your own investing, then you can do very well for yourself.
Yeah, Andrew, you bring up a great point. Most investors are very qualitative. Okay, whenever you're investing, you can either be qualitative or quantitative. I'm of the opinion that you got to be both, and you got to be very balanced in the way that you see that. But your common person is very qualitative. They will go out and buy Coke because I like Coke, and that's my whole reason. Like that, their analysis stops right there. That's it. And you know, I like Coke too. But if I'm going to go out and buy a company like that, I'm also going to look at not just the qualitative piece of I think they have a great product, but I'm also going to look at what kind of profit are they producing, what price can I buy it for on the current market, and then I mix those two together and I try to have a nice balanced approach before I make a decision on whether I'm going to buy it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom with that. And, you know, you really want to find the right balance, but I think you need both aspects as well. For the last rule, we kind of touched on it already. A stock must be undervalued. Can you give like a short summary of how you would determine if a stock's undervalued?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's kind of a long, it could go a long way, but
We could do about five episodes on this one. the main thing here is that you have to have a projection on what you think the company is going to be able to continue to earn. What is that profit margin? Okay. And when you're talking about profit, a lot of people go straight to the earnings per share, EPS, which is really the profit. You can also look at the cash flow off the cash flow statement, or what we refer to as owner's earnings. That's another way you can do it. But in essence, what you're trying to do is you're trying to say, next year, I think they're going to earn $10 a share. The year after that, I think they're going to earn $11 a share. The year after that, I think it's going to be $12. And what you do is you sum up all those future profits or those future earnings. And then what you do is you discount all those back to the present day value. And I think the thing I got to describe here is a dollar tomorrow or a dollar next year is not worth the same thing as a dollar today. And so what you're doing is whenever you're making those forecasts and you're looking at what those values, those profit margins are going to be into the future, you're summing all those up. You're looking at what all of them are going to be. And then you discount them all back to the present value today because those are all future dollars. So you got to discount them back to come up with a present value. And when you look at that value, you say, okay, I think the intrinsic value or the present value of the company is $100 a share. Okay? And once you have that value, then you have it some. Now you can compare it to what it's trading for on the market. So let's say I go to the market and I see that it's trading for $150. Well, if I think it's worth $100 and it's trading for $150, it's trading a lot higher than what I calculated the value to be. So that's a stock that I probably won't buy because I won't get a good return on my money. So really, I mean, that's kind of the essence of it. That's as simply as I can describe it, that's really what it is. And it's really funny. Buffett, with these four rules, he said that the only rule that him and Charlie Munger, who's kind of his partner with Berkshire Hathaway, he said the only rule that Charlie and I have changed in our 35 or whatever many years that we've had these four rules, we changed the last rule to saying a stock must be undervalued to a stock must be severely or significantly undervalued. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, it's so important to have valuation metrics that make sense for you and to make sure that you're always trying to find companies that trade within those valuations where you're going to get a significant return. Because that's really how money's made in the market is by buying these companies that are undervalued. And once they become, you know, at their proper value where they should be valued, then that's how you make your money. So I really want to thank you for your time, Preston. This was a fantastic interview with a lot of great insights. And for people who are interested in what you do online and kind of this whole idea of Buffett and maybe getting more insight than what a 30-minute podcast could teach you, where can they go to find out more about this?
All right. Hey, Andrew, thank you so much for having me on the show. And I'd also like to thank the other individuals on your panel for having me on the show. If people want to learn more about what it is that I'm doing, they can go to buffettsbooks.com. That's the website that I had set up. It's all video-based, so if you like learning by video, that'll be helpful. There's countless hours there for people can start beginning, clear up to, you know, owner's earnings calculations and more advanced stuff. So it definitely walks you through a step-by-step process. So love to have you there. It doesn't cost anything. There's no sign-up or anything like that. So we'd love to have you over at Buffett's Books. And Andrew, really appreciate the opportunity to come on your show.
Hey, thanks, Preston. I mean, this was a ton of fun. I feel like I learned a little bit as well, even though I see Buffett as one of my mentors and Benjamin Graham as well. So I really want to thank you for your time. If people want to see more, I definitely think they should go to your website, buffettsbooks.com. If they want to see some of the topics we talked about and some of the books, I'll link those up on our website, moneytreepodcast.com/20 for episode 20. So yeah, Preston, this was a ton of fun and I want to thank you again and hope to talk to you again some other time.
Thanks, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
Okay, now we're moving on to the panel discussion. For today's panel, we have Larry Ludwig from InvestorJunkie.com, Miranda Marquette from PlantingMoneySeeds.com, and I'm Andrew Sather from eInvestingForBeginners.com. Now, we mentioned in the interview how, you know, there's kind of two sides to this net worth equation, and you can really focus on one or the other. And, you know, people tend to focus on one and sometimes neglect the other, and you really need both sides. So I wanted to ask and bring this up to the panel. Do you guys put more focus on income or do you put more focus on expenses when it comes to your net worth and financial success? And I'll start with you, Miranda. Which one do you put more focus on? And, you know, with the new year, we're recording this in January. People have these New Year's resolutions, and they tend to focus on one or the other. Do you think they maybe put too much focus on one or the other, and which one should we all be focusing on?
Well, this is kind of a loaded question, as we were mentioning a little bit before. I think personally, I am more of a make more money person. So if I want to do something or if I feel like I can't afford something, then my response is to make more money, because you can always make more money. There, you get to a point where you can't cut back anymore. So the focus on like cutting expenses, I think, well, I hate sacrifice. So that kind of makes me sad. So I'm more of a focus on making more money person. But that said, I think that there's a dangerous place to go when you say, if I made more money, all of my problems would be solved. Because, you know, to a certain degree, your money problems aren't really about how much money you're making, but how you're spending that money and whether that spending matches up with your priorities. So if you're just spending your money on things that don't matter to you and you're wasting your money, it does not matter how much income you have. You will never be able to keep up to it. And that's the reason why, as Larry pointed out in the past, you know, there are so-called rich people who are broke.
Yeah. Did you have something to add to that, Larry? Because I know I was on Facebook the other day. I think you posted something about the new year and how people tend to focus on the wrong things and it can really lead them astray. So can you add some insight to that?
Yeah. I mean, I just first and foremost, was it P. Diddy who had the song More Money, More Problems?
I think it was Biggie.
Biggie, okay.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, with that said, ultimately you can have more money and still have the same issues. You're overspending your income. But I'm still about how to generate more income because of – I think most people don't focus on – they focus on the budgeting, and there's only so much you can cut from the bone where you really start sacrificing lifestyle. You really have issues in terms of – you know, you want some sort of balance there too. You don't want to be totally a miser. I mean, that's really popular as of late with a lot of blogs that they figure out how to generate, you know, or how to spend less money by making your own toothpaste or how to make your own wrapping paper for Christmas or something stupid like that. And I'm just like, well, really you should be focusing on how to generate more income. And most people don't focus on that. They don't have the whole business mentality to figure out what business can I start on the side even and grow that business to where it's a full-time job.
Because I think you even mentioned in the article, it was like 80% of your budget is something that you can't change. It's all going towards rent.
It's fixed. It's like what our national debt is. You know, ultimately, the budget for the federal government, most of it is fixed items that can't be changed. And what the government focuses on, Congress for the most part, is things that are little minutiae issues that really don't change the needle one way or the other. So no, I think it's no different on a personal level. You know, you have certain expenses. Obviously, if you're making only, say, $50,000 a year, and you buy a, you know, $50,000 BMW as an example, I think you're foolish. I mean, you should get rid of that car and cut that expense. But most people don't go that route. Usually they don't. I mean, there are some that do. But if you're ultimately actively interested in investing and want to take part and become a better investor, to me, I think you usually have that part of the equation down pat. Because expenses are pretty straightforward stuff. It's usually – my whole point in that article, why I don't budget, ultimately you have a certain amount of fixed expenses and those things don't change per month to month. So why a lot of people religiously, you know, take out their YNAB or why you need a budget and or mint and look at the thing on a weekly, daily basis. And it's silly.
Do you agree with that perspective, Miranda, on not necessarily needing a budget to have success?
Oh, yeah, since I don't budget. So Larry and I are pretty much on the same page with this. I have a plan. I'm not sitting here like going to spending my money willy-nilly. I have priorities. I have values. I have a plan. And what I do is I just say, well, these are my priorities and these are automatically funded. My retirement contributions, the investments that I use, the investment account that I use for emergency spending, the money that I use to pay quarterly taxes, my rent, all of that is automatically deducted. That's all priority spending. That's, you know, my charitable contributions even are automatically deducted from my checking account each month. And so that's all there. And those priorities are funded. I've looked ahead. How much do I need to set aside for retirement? Well, that's how much we have set aside each month. And it just comes right out. And then everything else, I just spend till it's gone on things that I want to spend on. So.
You basically are making it, you're paying yourself first. That's one of the common things. You basically make your investing a fixed expense that you have to pay yourself every month, no matter what.
Exactly.
And you should have, ultimately, everyone should have some sort of buffer there. If you don't have, I mean, to me, the people that really look at budgets and look at the minutiae details, they're really close to the edge where, honestly, they're spending too much already. Be it, you know, if they're making only $40,000 a year, they're already spending more than what they earn. So they have to be concerned with that budget. But ultimately, it goes back to my original issue. They should be figuring out how to make more money.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, our podcast is so popular with people, and, you know, investing in general is so popular, is because it is exactly one way to make more money. And so if you can put a little bit more effort and more time into that, then you can see greater results for yourself. So kind of moving on to more markets talk, we mentioned in the interview how there's this dichotomy of like fear and greed in the markets, and how, you know, the scales can tip in an extreme way, one way or the other. So I wanted to ask you guys, how do you handle fear in the markets? You know, right now we're seeing general optimism, I would say. I mean, the S&P's crossed the 2000 mark and things are generally, you know, very good right now. But in previous times, you know, there's been a lot of fear, people talking about the end of the world, stocks being very volatile. So how do you handle fear during those times? And I'll start with you, Larry. How do you do that?
Well, I mean, ultimately, you mentioned how the market is at all-time highs. That's correct. But volatility has increased dramatically in the past about 5 months. Mm-hmm. And to me, that it shows the market is kind of a manic depressive. one minute, you know, Mr. Market, as the classic analogy, one minute he's very enthusiastic about the market. Next minute, like you said, the world is ending. And right now, at the time of this recording, you know, the S&P 500 VIX is at 17. And granted, historically, that's not high, but it's much higher than what it was only, you know, 6 months ago, where it was around 11 or 12. So ultimately, from that perspective, the market is somewhat, you know, at a lull period volatility-wise, but I think it's going to increase higher in the long run. With that said, how do I deal with the volatility or overall, you know, fear and greed of the market? I try to use it to my advantage. I mean, ultimately, I'm a long-term investor and don't focus on that so much, but any type of shorter term or where I think there's opportunities in the market, I will take advantage of that fear. And right now, like you said, I think we're much more in a greed phase. So I'm trying to focus on and do more defensive hedges against that.
I think that's a important thing to consider. And, you know, it's very contrarian, but it's really kind of what you need to be successful. I mean, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful.
Exactly.
What about you, Miranda?
Pretty much kind of the same thing. It's going to be so boring. I mean, as we know, I am all about for my basic, well, this is what I need to go into the retirement fund type stuff. I just have the same amount as dollar cost averaging straight across the board into index ETFs. That's what it is. So when it comes to the retirement accounts, from the money from my husband's paycheck and then the money that goes into the Roth IRAs, it's just straight across the board. This is the amount that we invest each month. It doesn't matter what the market is doing. This is the amount of money we invest each month, and we let dollar cost averaging do its thing.
I think that's important too. Let me just stop you right there. Dollar cost averaging, by its definition, it's going to automatically buy more when the market is fearful, and it's going to automatically buy less when the market's greedy, because you have a set amount every month that you are investing. And so because that amount doesn't change based on the market, you know, you're getting all the benefits of buy low and sell high. And so, you know, it's easy to say dollar cost averaging, but if you don't really understand how important it is, you might gloss over that. So I think that's I definitely use dollar cost averaging as well. I think it's very, very crucial.
Yeah. So for all of my long term type things, I focus on that and dollar cost averaging and just let it go and remind myself that I don't want to panic sell when the market is low, because then I'm just locking in any losses rather than using the dollar cost averaging, like you said, where it buys more when the market is lower. Now, kind of like Larry, I do like to have a little bit of money in reserve so that when the markets are fearful, I can go in and buy a little extra maybe. And so I do like to do that. And then I do have a little extra leeway I started to build up with this investing challenge that we're both part of for the second year. And I started building up a little more leeway with that because it kind of forced me to think about, well, what are my short-term goals? So in the short term, I kind of play around with things and move things around a little bit. But for the most part, the bulk of my investing just remains with the dollar cost averaging so that I don't have to worry about, you know, whether I'm panicking or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, let me give a caveat on my side too. I'm nowhere near an active trader or anything like that. I'm more like Miranda as far as the long-term strategy. Most of my assets are dollar cost average. So let me be clear on that to the audience.
Okay. So, I mean, just knowing the effectiveness of this strategy, you know, even in my 7 steps to understanding the stock market, I called it the best stock strategy. And, you know, it's really like a big key to success is dollar cost averaging. And I think it removes a lot of the fear from my equation because I already know that no matter how low the market gets, I'm going to benefit from it because I'm dollar cost averaging. Now, as far as, you know, information and trying to research on investments, do you guys feel that sometimes things get maybe too biased towards the pessimistic side? And do you have a specific place you go for information, like during the bear market? Or do you feel like it doesn't even matter? And I'll start with you, Larry. What do you think?
Good question. I guess in general, I mean, I watch a lot of the what's called financial porn out there on a daily basis, but I use that as more like overall sentiment gauge. When they're CNBC may have someone on there saying buy, 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 and the stocks are a great time to buy, I kind of question that all the time. Where, what is their motives, and does it really make sense, and or make sense for my long-term goals? So in terms of, I don't know, I don't really look at the I don't really go to any specific source, any basis because of, be it positive or negative, because of I just constantly looking at the market for a long-term strategy.
So you kind of have these like built-in filters already, or you have this ability to process a bunch of information and just kind of sort out what's bad immediately just because you have a lot of experience with doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can say that. I mean, ultimately, there's a lot of noise out there, and you just got to pare down. I mean, I listen to the noise, but I don't really actively get engaged in a lot of it. I kind of look at the long issues. The short-term noise really doesn't matter, in my opinion.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's important to understand as well. What about you, Miranda?
Yeah. So I don't. Yeah, because by my strategy is dollar cost averaging, I don't really need to look for a lot of sources. I think one of the problems with paying a lot of attention to the financial media is that it's all about sensationalism and traffic and eyeballs. So when things are going bad and nothing drives people like fear. Fear is one of the strongest motivators. My husband has a PhD in psychology, and he talks about like one of the short-term motivators, one of the biggest short-term motivators is fear. And so if you want to motivate people to watch your program or get those clicks or all of that stuff, then you got to be sensationalist and you have to push the fear aspect of it, which is why people get into the panic selling. They see, oh my gosh, the world is doomed, we're doomed, the stock market will never recover and things are awful and I need to get out now and sell everything now before it goes even lower. And the reality is all of those people that had that fear response, yeah, they moved immediately and they made immediate fear-based decisions back in, you know, early 2009. And what happened? They lost half of their retirement accounts, where if they had hung in there rather than, you know, everything dropping to 2000, the Dow dropping to 2000 and life as we know it being over, look at the Dow now. If they had kept their money in or even bought more, where would they be? Yeah. And so I just try not to, you know, look at that kind of information. I think it's interesting to read it, but I never act on it. And I don't usually go for information during a bear market. During a bear market, it's just better to turn it all off. So,
well, ultimately, if you look at the 2009, 2008 crisis, I mean, a lot of people were in the market saying it's going to go, or in the news saying that things were going to go lower, it's going to get worse. And honestly, if you listen to that as a contrarian, that would have been to your best advantage, honestly.
It's like music to your ears when everyone else exactly. is freaking out.
Yeah, I mean, when everyone's running away, to me, it's like, okay, that's a great opportunity. Like you guys with real estate. Okay, I don't want to own real estate. Maybe right. I should own real estate now.
Right, exactly.
Well, my reason for not wanting to own real estate are more personal than having to do with the investment.
as a well as a society, I mean, obviously we've had a decrease in ownership in the past 5 years for obvious reasons. That said, I think it's an opportunity as a someone to own rental real estate.
Right. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why. I mean, you know, I don't like owning like property, but you know, I've increased my investment in real estate investment trusts. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I want that exposure to real estate while it's still before it starts picking up again.
I mean, last year from the, obviously we're now in 2015. The numbers for last year, real estate was the biggest gainer in the overall markets.
Of every asset class.
Yeah, every asset class. I believe it was 25% or 30%. I forget the actual total gain. So you did very well as far as if you invested in REITs last year.
Yeah, and you know that was actually a big part of my gain in that investment portfolio that we did last year. That competition, a big part of my gains were from that.
You certainly did beat me.
I did.
Yeah, I mean, leave it up to the media to be like 3 years late on reporting it as well. Like, they won't say how great it is until it's already too late.
Exactly.
So now, on the flip side, how do you guys kind of mitigate the irrationality? And you know, we talk about fear. Now, how do you deal with this greed aspect when some stocks can get to bubble proportions? Other than just completely avoiding these stocks, how do you kind of limit your exposure to them? Miranda?
Index funds, index ETFs. I'm sorry, that's like my answer to everything.
Index.
Are you doing more of like a, you know how some indexes are based on market cap and some are kind of more of an even exposure? Do you prefer one to the other or are you kind of doing both?
For my emergency fund that I keep in a taxable investment account, I just have an all market fund, and it's just an all market. It's a U.S. all market fund, and so it doesn't matter what stocks are in a bubble or not because it's a U.S. all market fund. Now, in my IRA, Betterment, you know, has different categories. So they've got some international stocks in there. There are a few bond ETFs, not very many because of the way my allocation is 90% stocks and 10% bonds. But yeah, there's a little bit there that kind of diversifies across sector and location, geographic location. But yeah, I don't really do much tinkering with it. I really think that when you trade too much and you get too much into it, you start to lose. And I saw this too last year when I started freaking out about certain things and moving things around. You start losing money through transaction fees. You start losing money through churn in your funds. It starts, you know, when you have actively managed funds, you have to worry about churn. So it just starts to get like really complicated. And honestly, that's when you start overthinking. I mean, you want to think about it and pay some attention, but at the same time, once you start overthinking about it, that's when you start making your mistakes. So I don't overthink it very much. I just use my index funds. So, yeah. And sometimes, you know, like I said, sometimes I've been, you know, investing a little bit more in the real estate end of things, like doing the REITs and adding, you know, a little bit more like that. But for the most part, I don't have to worry about individual stocks in a bubble because I don't invest in individual stocks.
Yeah, I think because the index has just so many stocks, such a small percentage of them will be bubble stocks that it won't negatively hurt your investment performance. What about you, Larry?
Well, I've talked about this sort of in another episode. I mean, I do multiple things. I mean, one of them, indexing, though. The ultimate thing is I do what's called tactical asset allocation. So I do look at the markets and do take some adjustments based on the valuations. The other is ultimately my bucket strategy, where I have a certain amount of money, you know, allocated for our security bucket. So it lasts us ultimately right now 2 years, where ultimately I want to get that to 5 years. But with that said, so therefore, I do have some cash on hand. I do have that, but that's part of my security bucket. But ultimately, I really not worried as much about the overall day-to-day market or fluctuations, whether or not we have a next recession because of the money that is there. You know, should worse come to worse, I have it available to us. But in the same notion, too, I have cash available, too, to take advantage of these declines. So it's really the best of both worlds. And meanwhile, also trying to, the other goal of that too, that security bucket, is trying to keep up with the rate of inflation. So if the rate of inflation is, say, 3 or 4%, you want to try to have those fixed income investments at least match that, so it keeps up with that rate of inflation. So I have a bunch of little strategies in place. And ultimately, it's overall dollar cost averaging with the market, but I'm trying to make sure from the long term, if there's any decline, I can take advantage of it as well.
So what it sounds like to me is that for both of you guys and for myself as well, these strategies that we employ, dollar cost averaging, diversification, they kind of automatically take away all the downside and all the risk. Not all of it.
Not all of it. I mean, right. You're never going to mitigate risk totally. There is no such thing as a risk-free investment, of course.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, for the most part, we're mitigating bubble stocks and, you know, really staying away from high volatility, which can hurt some investors. And so by using these principles that kind of have been passed down from successful investors to people like us, we can use that to our advantage and really get away from getting hurt from fear and greed. And so,
Or take advantage of it, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I think the key here is, I mean, none of us go around following the next big thing. Mm-hmm. So many people are trying to find this magical quick fix, magical stock that's going to make them rich almost immediately. And that mindset that says I have to be rich right now and I have to just pick the right stock is what leads to these bubbles. And I think part of the reason why there's just this natural insulation against these bubbles is none of us have that mindset that any one magical pick that we have and the next big thing.
Well, I mean, look, if it's akin to the New Year's resolutions. If you look at most people, you know, either want to make more money or lose weight. And they look at the lose weight as dieting. I must cut down my calories to nothing, and therefore I'm going to be successful. And that very rarely is a successful strategy. You have to change your
just
diet.
Just starve myself.
Just starve yourself. I mean, but that's a common – you look right. at everyone out there, that's a common mentality, that they're not going to exercise. They're not going to do the right things as far as eating. They're just going to starve themselves, and they'll be skinny again. And it just doesn't work. And it's no different than the investing world. That people are looking for this quick fix that I'm going to instantly become, you know, a millionaire overnight by investing in, I don't know, Facebook as an example. And it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I mean, you have to find something that's sustainable and realistic. And that comes from experience and knowledge from others and trying to learn from that. And then eventually you'll have that knowledge and experience yourself.
Well, I mean, even add to this that you may hit a jackpot every once in a while, but look at it as just – it's like the jackpot. It's like winning the lottery in some respects. So you may have a stock that has 100% gain in a short period, but it is like winning the lottery. That's really the proper way of looking at it. Ultimately, you try to look at long-term little wins along the way, not some big gain that instantly will make you a millionaire. It just doesn't happen.
So I want to thank you guys. This was a great discussion, and thank Preston for coming on for the interview. We'll have everything linked up in the show notes, so you can go to moneytreepodcast.com/20 to see everything on there. I'm going to link up Larry's New Year's resolution blog post on there so you guys can see it, and also some of the books we talked about today, both in the interview and in the discussion. So, we're back now to the regular schedule now that the holiday is over, and like Larry likes to say, you know, it's your money, so you got to take care of it yourself. So thank you. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.